This episode is brought to you in part by Richmond Graduate University. The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly. Richmond Graduate University can equip you to become a licensed professional counselor, integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmond.edu.
Your eyes on the times, you walk ready to speak up, but with so many problems, you're exhausted trying to keep up.
This is the Church Politics Podcast, where you can get political commentary from a biblical worldview. We're not trying to be conservative or progressive, we're trying to be Christian in the public square.
And I'm black as heaven, I'm made in God's image, nobody can change my settings. Amen. Amen, cut off my knees and put an end to my search. It's easy to sell your soul when you don't know what it's worth.
With your no good Ann Camp, you're listening to the Ann Campaign's Church Politics Podcast with Justin Gibney, a.k.a. Bishop Cooper's grandson, and the Windy City representative, the baddest brother above the Mason-Dixon line, my play cousin, the right Reverend Christopher Butler. Chris, I don't know if you got a chance. Obviously, you weren't on the podcast last week. I don't know if you got a chance to listen to it.
Yeah.
But it was falsely reported that you had been fired from the Church Politics Podcast. Now, I'm not sure who was behind this, right? It might have been our new producer, Slewfoot Sammy. Slew, that's not a good way to start off your tenure with the podcast. But I just wanted to give you a heads up. It was falsely reported that you had been fired from the show, but we're glad to have you back. Welcome back, Chris.
Well, I'm glad that I made the cut and I'm welcome here on the podcast. I'm very grateful.
Yes. And I'll say this is correlation, not causation. But that last week did happen to be like one of our biggest podcasts of the year. Now, there's only been a few podcasts of the year. And I think that's just a correlation. But I had to let you know that to give you a hard time on that one.
Hey, listen, it was actually a very good podcast.
Yeah, I think Peter did a good job. And obviously, guys, I'm kidding with Chris, but I think Peter did a good job. I didn't expect that people would get so much from. I knew it would be a good one, but I didn't expect people would be drawn to that. And I think it would have been even better if Chris had been on, but it was pretty good. Now, there was a Nevada primary yesterday. And within that Nevada primary, the Republican side is interesting. Now, Nikki Haley lost, and that I don't think that's a surprise to anybody that she didn't win the primary in Nevada. But what is kind of news is that she didn't lose to Trump, that Trump, in fact, was not even on the ballot. She ends up losing to a candidate named none of these candidates. So in the Nevada primary, a candidate named, obviously this isn't a candidate, but a candidate named none of these candidates actually beat Nikki Haley in the primary. I would say that's somewhat embarrassing. Any thoughts on that?
I feel like that's a little bit difficult when you lose to literally somebody else. You know, I suppose that there is still, I think I called it on a previous podcast, the Trump implosion strategy. Mm-hmm. That is Nikki Haley's game plan, that like somewhere on the way, he's going to disqualify himself in some kind of way, and then she'll be there. But at this point, I don't even know if you're helping yourself on that score by going into primaries where people literally pull for somebody else. Literally. Right. I mean, it's got to sting.
Yeah, it's got to sting quite a bit. Now, Trump will actually end up securing all of Nevada's delegates because of the state's caucus on Thursday. This primary carried no weight, I guess, other than serving as an embarrassment to Haley. So something to note, I guess. Something else that happened in regard to Trump was that Trump actually, I don't know if he put this on Twitter or his Truth Social or whatever, he actually came to the defense of Anheuser-Busch. As many of you know, Bud Light, which is an Anheuser-Busch brand, I guess they put a transgender person on one of the cans and it caused a pretty big boycott. And they've lost millions and millions of dollars from this conservative boycott. Some have called it in modern day times, at least, the most successful conservative boycott that's happened. And basically, Trump comes out and says, no, Anheuser-Busch is not woke. They give money to, you know, to here, to there. They're not woke. Please stop boycotting them. So that was interesting to see. Some of the folks who started the boycott, Walsh and guys like that, were like, no, we're going to keep boycotting them because they have not apologized for what they did and so on. So something tells me some money may have exchanged hands, or not exchanged hands, gone to campaigns or something for that endorsement or defense. Any thoughts on that defense, Chris?
Yeah, I think that it may be possible that there's some support going around. It also shows me, though, that Trump is turning toward the general election, mm-hmm. and that even with all the prosecutions out there, I just continue to believe that Democrats or any other person who does not want to see Donald Trump get elected cannot play the game of underestimating him. I mean, the guy is a shrewd, calculating politician. And I think this is one of those types of little things that you see, because he comes out and says, you know, hey, Anheuser-Busch, it's not a woke company. Doesn't necessarily cost him anything in the primary right. that he's currently running, but it may right. take some handful of independent voters and be like, see, the guy's not that crazy, so I can go and vote for him. And these are the types of little things that I think add up to something that can swing an election that is going to definitely be decided along the margin.
Yeah, I guess it could cut two ways. I mean, I saw it primarily as helping Anheuser-Busch with the main demographic that, you know, which may be kind of like MAGA folks who are boycotting them. So it works that way, but it could cut the other way to say, hey, Trump is trying to moderate these things and kind of calm the culture war down or something like that. And people may see it that way too. And when I say money exchange hands, I'm not saying any type of corruption, but I wouldn't be surprised given our former president that he got some benefit.
Got something out of it for sure.
From that statement. So
and I think it's two birds with one stone, man.
Yeah.
I think Donald Trump is a savvy politician, or at least a savvy public figure, right? Like he knows yeah. how to play crowds and narratives and news cycles. And until you start talking about him and winning elections, then he kind of goes off the rails. But
right. Now, I hear where you're coming from. So it's just something to keep an eye on. This election will prove to be very, very interesting. But you know where you can come to hear all about it. Now, I want to, all as always, give a shout out to our patrons and supporters for supporting us in what we do and how we do it. If you are watching on YouTube, make sure that you like and subscribe. If you want to get premium episodes, if you like what we're saying here, but you want a little more, then you can go to patreon.com/churchpolitics. And if you become a patron, then you can get these weekly premium episodes where we talk about stuff a little more in depth than we even talk about here. So check that out if you have a chance. We got a lot to get to, so you know what it is. Grab your Bible, get your mind right, and prepare to think, not like a Republican, not like a Democrat, but to think like a Christian. And I want to start today in Mark 10, verses 13 through 16. People were bringing little children to Jesus for him to place his hands on them, but the disciples rebuked them. When Jesus saw this, he was indignant. He said to them, "Let the little children come to me and do not hinder them, for the kingdom of God belongs to such as these. Truly, I tell you, anyone who will not receive the kingdom of God like a little child will never enter it." And he took the children in his arms, placed his hands on them, and blessed them. Children are precious. They are to be deeply loved, discipled, and guided. What they experience is not insignificant. Their existence as a whole, again, is not insignificant. And I think we can miss that sometimes in our very adult-centered culture. But interestingly, children do often find themselves, for better or for worse, I guess usually for worse, at the center of America's culture war. And so I want to get into that a little bit today based on a story that I saw in the San Francisco Chronicle. Apparently, a San Francisco elementary school struggling to boost test scores and dismal student attendance is spending $250,000 in federal funds for an organization called Woke Kindergarten to train teachers to confront white supremacy, disrupt racism and oppression, and remove those barriers from learning. The sessions are funded, again, through a federal program meant to help the country's lowest performing schools boost student achievement. But 2 years into the 3-year contract with Woke Kindergarten, student achievement has fallen, prompting some teachers to question whether the money was well spent given the needs of the students, who are predominantly low income. 2/3 of the students are English learners, and more than 80% are Hispanic or Latino. English and math scores hit new lows last spring, with less than 4% of the students being proficient in math and just under 12% at grade level in English. That's a decline of 4 percentage points in each category. Man, that's a lot. Now, some are saying the solution, the advocates for woke kindergarten are saying, hey, the solution is for educators to confront legacies of racism and bias in schools and to talk about historic white supremacy so that students feel safe and supported. Elementary school students. Some teachers are saying woke kindergarten is wrongly rooted in progressive politics and activism with anti-police, anti-capitalism, and anti-Israel messages mixed in with the goal of making schools safe, joyful, and supportive for all children. So I want to get this right. Instead of focusing on math and literacy with kindergartners, we're focusing on white supremacy and anti-racism. Let me say this, Chris, and you, I'm going to be very brief because you're actually the education expert and I'm not. Now, let me say this. I'm all about teaching kids, my kids' history. I have, you know, 3 boys and I want them to know Black history, all American history and beyond American history. I'm all for that. I'm all for telling them the role to some extent that racism has played in this country. This to me, though, Chris, is just far too much. And it upsets me because as somebody who thinks racism is real and that it still plays a role in this country, this is what not necessarily trivializes the issue, but this pushes some to the position where they don't take the issue as seriously because we use it for things like this. Now, when it comes to wokeness, I've said this before, wokeness has surely been misappropriated by the right. The right took it, conservatives took it, made it this boogeyman, and then they also used it to throw everything dealing with race into this poisoned well of wokeness. And it really not shut down, completely shut down the conversation about race, but it really did damage to that much needed race conversation. But I've also said, Chris, and you may recall, that wokeness, the idea that came out of the Black community, has also been misappropriated by the left, who basically uses it to launder their entire progressive agenda into schools, into the conversation, and all over. This, to me, seems like an example of this. This seems not very practical. Now, I don't want to come and say that all the school scores went down because of woke kindergarten. I'm not making that claim, and I don't know that the article is making that claim. But it seems to me that people's tax dollars could have been better spent and that much of the conversation that they may be having in these classes or with these teachers is not stuff that's actually going to get these kids to read and learn better. But go ahead, Chris.
I took a little moment. I can't say that I did any kind of exhaustive deep dive and all the material is not even available, but I did go and look into woke kindergarten as a program. I tried to do it, Justin, with an open mind because I do know that racism is very real, very alive, and very active in schools, especially with younger students. I've had several conversations with families who have students in elementary school where the children are reflecting some of the worst things that they see modeled in the adults around them. And that comes out in school and it's bullying and it's calling kids monkey. And I mean, like, and so it compromises the learning environment. All that is true. And all of that needs to be confronted. And so, like you, it is part of what makes me a little bit upset when I see something like woke kindergarten, because the material ultimately is, at least what I was able to see, it's kind of a caricature of Black culture. It assumes that if you step into a Black community, you're going to see nothing but, you know, like a bunch of young people with nose piercings and different color hair. And, you know, and certainly there are Black people who have those things and thank God for them. And they are part of the community, but they are not the whole of the community. And so when you're talking about dealing with racism in school and you need to confront those types of things, part of it is creating environments where the children are able to see themselves in curriculum, see themselves in the stories that are read, the conversations that are had. And I'm not sure that the large majority of young Black kids are seeing themselves in every sort of far left sort of projection of what society might be. I don't think that is what you find. You don't find that kind of monolith in the Black community. And so this particular investment that was made in this school district in the story, the line is that they made the investment because woke kindergarten was going to increase attendance scores, which it did, attendance rates, I should say, not scores. And it did increase attendance rate marginally. They went from 61% chronic unattendance to 44% chronic attendance problems. One, let's just say that's still really, really bad. I mean, that's very high for kids not coming to school, 44%. And so when you think about, you're going to invest $200,000 to $250,000 in attendance, best practice would tell you that you're going to invest that money in some kind of parent and family engagement. That's where I think the mistake is made, because if you do that, one, you'll be able to find out a lot more about the children of color and any other folks that you're trying to build representation for them into your school environment. You'll find out what their life is actually like if you were actually engaging with their actual families and their actual communities. Secondly, the best practice tells us that that is actually how you increase attendance in a sustainable way. And it also shows us that all of the long-term data that you can look at, one thing is going to always ring true, is that the number one indicator for a child's academic attainment is always going to be before race, before economic status, before location and neighborhood, before any of those things. The number one indicator is going to be an active adult in that child's educational life. And so this investment in woke kindergarten, if the goal was to increase academic scores, and particularly to impact those scores by increasing attendance, it just seems like a really roundabout way to get there. And then the choice of provider, from my limited, you know, sort of cursory look at what that organization is providing, I don't know that it is truly representative of like the Black community, which I'll finish with this. That's really, really hard to do.
Yeah, these were primarily Hispanic kids too. So
I mean, I'm looking at the material. I'm saying Black people. So there you go. You have that part of it to look at. So whatever community you want to go after and impact, go to the community, because especially in the local school, it is really difficult for any national organization to say that they're doing something that's representative of a particular community, because I don't know any community, not the Black community, not the Hispanic community, not any community that I'm aware of, where that community is a monolith that you can easily, quote unquote, represent in culture. So engagement, I think, at the school level always trumps, quote unquote, representation, because engagement actually brings you to the actual families and the actual communities that you're dealing with.
That's good. Yeah. And here's one of my issues. So I think in both of our families, Black history, other parts of American history are very important. Even the age appropriate things that aren't pleasant to talk about. Like, I want my kids to know that. I want my kids. I may even tell them, hey, in some instances, people won't like you because of this. Those people are silly. Everybody's not like that. Right. But here's the problem. Kids don't necessarily always get nuance. Adults don't always get nuance, especially this day. But kids especially don't get nuance. One of my problems with this type of curriculum is that when you tell kids all the obstacles in front of them, they're going to remember all the obstacles in front of them and may take away from that what they can't do. I would rather spend my time and have the people educating my kids spend their time on what they can do, on how people before them, yes, they had to go through things, but they had to overcome. I don't want my kid learning about, oh, the police are going to do this to you and do that. What are you talking about? Focus on what they can do. And if those obstacles arise, hopefully they'll have some history, some perspective to say, I can overcome it. But so much of this progressive woke stuff, because they, like I said, they kind of appropriated for themselves, is telling kids what they can't do or what's going to stop them from being who they want to be or what is going to take away their humanity. And why would you tell a kid that when kids don't understand that? I'm telling kids what you can overcome, and there will be difficulties, but you can overcome it. That's one of my biggest issues. I'm going to err on the side of telling them what they can accomplish. The other issue you have here is the people like us who think that government mm-hmm. does have a role to play in education and any of these other positions. This hurts that argument as well, because you're giving taxpayer money to something like this is just not wise. And it strengthens the argument that you should have no role in it at all. It's just disappointing in that regard.
And it puts that conversation, one of my entry points into education work, especially sort of education reform, was actually working on a school funding bill in the state of Illinois, working on that throughout the state and in our capital. And one of the most difficult arguments to overcome is that folks who were arguing against our legislation were able to put together a very simple chart that showed over time the amount of money that was going into public education going up and up and up, and the performance in a lot of the school districts, particularly Chicago public schools, going down and down and down. And sometimes, I'm not saying that this is all of the case, but sometimes the reason for that is not because the money is not useful for improving educational outcomes, is that the money is not always being used in ways that will increase right. educational outcomes. And so when you have a school board, and there was a big thing at the school board, one of the school board members has actually been rightly sort of reprimanded for something he said that went beyond the pale. But it was a lot of intense discussion at the school board, because if I'm a school board and we are receiving $200,000 and investing that into a school so that you can improve attendance and get academics up, and your choice at the local school level is to go spend that money on woke kindergarten, that can be frustrating. And it can be disheartening for state legislators, for school board members, for anybody who in the future has to allocate funding for a school. It can be very disheartening, discouraging to kind of fight for those resources to come to schools if you feel like it's going to ultimately be spent on $250,000 worth of woke kindergarten.
Yep. And it kind of shows us how the culture war has a weird way of actually turning us into the character that the other side created yeah. for us. And I think this is a perfect example. This is who conservatives describe all progressives as being. And on the other side, you know, we can see examples of that being who conservatives turning into what progressives have described us to be. Yeah. Right. It goes both ways, and it's just unfortunate. But
yeah.
Kids can learn. Poor kids can learn. They can learn using traditional methods. But Chris has already told you what the major factors in that are. And it's not necessarily learning about oppression and all that stuff all day. And so
can I do one more thing? I'd be remiss if I don't say this to people listening to the Church Politics Podcast. If you're a leader of your church and a community, this is why it is so important to be involved. I wish that there were a church or a Christian leader that was in those conversations with the school district and with the local school before that money was spent, and at least able to sound the alarm beforehand so that it never happened. And this is what happens, though, when there's not enough sunlight and enough ongoing engagement. Yes, we want you to register and vote in elections, but this is where civics and politics is happening on a day-to-day in your community. So I just urge us to be close and be involved.
That's real. We will be right back on the Church Politics Podcast. Are you too progressive for conservatives and too conservative for progressives? As a Christian, do you find yourself feeling politically homeless? If so, then you're not alone. Listen, this is Justin Gibney, president of the AND Campaign. And if you're a Christian who doesn't know a whole lot about politics, or someone who knows a good deal about politics but wants to be more faithful in the public square, then you have to read the AND Campaign's book, Compassion and Conviction.
the AND Campaign's guide to faithful civic engagement that we publish with InterVarsity Press. Whether you just want to understand the relationship between church and state, why Christians should engage politics at all, how Christians should engage partisanship, politics and race, advocacy and protest, or even civility, this is the book for you. It's very much Bible-centered. It's Bible study and small group friendly. There are questions and exercises after every chapter that give you a framework for engaging politics in a biblical way. So if you want to do it in a better way, get our book, Compassion and Conviction, the AND Campaign's Guide to Faithful Civic Engagement.
And we are back on the Church Politics Podcast. You are with Justin Gibney and the Right Reverend Christopher Butler. This next issue is really disappointing. I believe it was last week, maybe, or something like that. The Wall Street Journal called Dearborn, Michigan, America's jihad capital. Now, they have had some pro-Palestinian rallies. The mayor there, though, in Dearborn, happens to be Arab-American, Muslim, and he happens to be challenging America's actions in regard to what's happening in Gaza. His name is Mayor Abdullah Hamoud. He doesn't support Hamas. He's not calling for jihad. But the Wall Street Journal thought it acceptable to publish such a foolish headline. Mayor Hamoud called the article reckless, bigoted, and Islamophobic. He said that Dearborn is one of the greatest American cities in our nation. This is more than irresponsible journalism. Publishing such inflammatory writing puts Dearborn residents at increased risk of harm. And he has upped his security based on that article and the response to that article. Let me say this, Chris. What's going on between Hamas and Israel is something I think all Christians need to be praying about. We have already said on multiple occasions that we should care about the people who are dying on both sides of that, and really be honest about ourselves, about what's going on and what role that we play in it. Wherever you land there, if you're prayerful and all that, is where you land. One thing that has worried me in this conversation is a lot of the people who are supporting Israel, not all of them, have expressed what seems to me to be some serious either religious or racial bias. And I'm talking about Christians here, that anyone who does not agree with their narrative about Israel is automatically a terrorist. And we cannot move forward with those type of narratives and that type of reaction to one another. The name calling, the not really hearing other people's arguments, the trying to cancel somebody just because they don't agree with you is not healthy for our discourse. Everybody has a right to say what they want to say about this based on our Constitution. And especially when you take somebody who, from what I've seen of him, Mayor Hamoud, he's talked about this responsibly. He did not say that it's okay to do the things that Hamas did, or he has not justified every Palestinian activist. I think he's been responsible. He just happens to disagree with some people. And so what do we do? Talk about jihad. We talk about terrorism. And I just think that needs to stop, Chris. I was very disappointed that something like that would be published in really in a journal, in a magazine that has a reputation like the Wall Street Journal does. But go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I was actually, so when I first heard this sort of stir up over that language being in the Wall Street Journal calling an American city the jihad capital of America, I thought it was going to be something different. I thought maybe somebody had sort of mischaracterized what was written, or maybe it was a phrase that was used, you know, in the course of writing something that was inappropriate. And to see that it was the headline of the article and like that was the argument, that was deeply disturbing. Because the Wall Street Journal is not, you know, like some local newspaper that nobody reads, right? Like the Wall Street Journal is a significant publication,
right,
in our culture. And to call an American city jihad capital, to me, is wildly irresponsible. And I think it reflects a part of this debate that I think has to be wound down in some sense. And that is this idea that one cannot be pro-Israel without being pro-Zionist, right? Mm-hmm. Like, those two things are not, they can't be conflated. You can be pro-Israel and not be pro-Zionist. And then this conflation to say that being pro-Palestine is to be jihadist, like, it, jihad is holy war against non-Muslims for the purpose of establishing Islam as like a ruling authority in a particular geography. And so to take folks who are marching and protesting, regardless of to how, whether you agree with them or not, I think that even if you disagree, you've got to have a modicum of compassion for people who literally have family members who have died. If you think about the Palestinian community outside of Gaza, around the world, and you look at the fact that over 30,000 people have died in Gaza, how many Palestinian people around the world, including here in America, have family members who have perished in this war? And so even if you don't agree with the political goals of the folks who are protesting, can you not have a little bit of compassion for somebody who is upset because grandma was buried under rubble after her neighborhood was bombed?
Right.
I think you got to have some compassion there. And you cannot equate that type of response with jihadist. That doesn't make somebody a jihadist because they are upset over what is happening in that nation. And what they have done, as far as I know, in Dearborn, there have been protests, but they have been on the whole nonviolent, which, in my opinion, is the most American of American activities, right? Like, that is part of what makes us the country that we are, is that we do have freedom of speech and expression. And so even if you don't agree, remind yourself, good, you know, American, of the expressions of our founders, like John Adams, who says that I will defend to the death your right to say what you say, even if I disagree with it. That is what makes us American. So to look at a city that is protesting because they take a particular political point of view and call that jihadist is irresponsible.
Very irresponsible. And let me say this again, what I've seen out of this conversation is, from a lot of Christians, and I'll be honest, especially white evangelicals, is Israel is good, and anyone who doesn't completely agree with Israel and everything they do is evil. It's been broken down pretty much like that. I don't really have to explain it. Whatever they do is necessary and good, and anybody who questions that is evil. And I don't see a justification for saying that about any group or any country in the Bible. I don't see a justification for saying that about nobody is above, no group or anyone else is above an honest and constructive critique.
For sure.
And every time somebody gives an honest and constructive critique, we have people who are trying to limit what you can say or can't. No, we got to have a real conversation, especially when people are dying. And we've dumbed down the argument to this good versus evil. And that's where it all stops. And I think at the end of the day, that actually hurts the cause of people who are pro-Israel. I don't think there's only so long that people are going to say this is okay to look at it like this. Now, I don't think that the way that people may respond is always going to be good. I just don't think in the long term that's sustainable. Have a real conversation. We know that BB sometimes is not doing what he's supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. And the way that the administration has handled it, the way that Republicans and the Senate and Congress have handled it, I think is wrong. Does that justify Hamas? Absolutely not. But what I'm saying is the analysis does not end with they're good and the other side is evil. It's more complicated than that, and we have to let it be. Yeah. Go ahead, Chris. I'll let you take us out.
Yeah, I just think that in the same way that political protest is uniquely American, I think that the ability to critique and challenge those you love and support is particularly Christian behavior. And so Christians have to be able to step into this space and be able to say, yo, I support Israel, and I think Israel needs to do X, Y, Z to be in alignment with what is good and right in the sort of broader moral analysis. And I don't think that those two points are I guess they are in some tension with each other, but they don't, one does not preclude the other. And it is uniquely Christian to be able to hold that tension in one relationship. I love you. I support you. I want to see you prosper. And because of that, I'm going to challenge you on these things that you need to be challenged on.
Yeah, because too many of us are using the Bible and the faith to justify things that it does not justify. We will be right back on the Church Politics Podcast. We are back on the Church Politics Podcast. And if you didn't know, there has been a national dispute about the Southwest border. If you didn't know that, you have been under a rock somewhere. But guess what? We are here to help you and others that knew about it but want to learn more. We are here to help you out. All right. There is, you've seen the back and forth between the Biden administration and Texas and on and on and on, all this arguing going on, but actually not a whole lot getting done. Well, little has gotten done. Some folks have introduced, a bipartisan group has introduced what they're calling the Emergency National Security Supplemental Appropriations Act of 2024. Now, I want to be very clear. Usually I have a chance to read through these bills before I talk about them. I haven't been able to do that this time. Okay, so I'm getting secondhand information, but I want to be clear about it. I try to do that every time. I wasn't able to read it myself this time. Okay, I apologize for that. But our friends at the Immigration Forum have sent us an explainer. Also, I looked at some articles in PBS and some other places. And so I want to tell you a little bit about this bill, and then we'll talk about its prospects. The bill is, again, about the border to some extent, some other things. The total amount of for the bill, as far as money goes, is $118.3 billion. That includes $60 billion in military aid for Ukraine, $14.1 billion in aid for Israel, $10 billion in humanitarian assistance for Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, among other places. Now, that, you know, that's just part of, that's not the whole total, right? Those, I'm just highlighting some of those numbers. According to the Immigration Forum, this package includes significant changes that would transform border security and the asylum process in the United States. The package was developed in response, as we were talking about, to high levels of encounters at the U.S.-Mexico border and Republicans' demands to include significant border reforms along with other national security spending. That's how they're connected. The Ukraine aid and the Israel aid are connected to this through, I guess, national security spending. Here are some key elements of this particular bill that the Immigration Forum has pointed out. It will establish a new asylum process at the U.S. border in which asylum officers adjudicate asylum cases within expedited time frame. It'll limit the use of parole for migrants who arrive to the U.S. border by land. It'll increase the standard to pass an initial asylum screening to the higher reasonable possibility standard, okay? It'll create an emergency expulsion authority to prevent the entry of migrants and asylum seekers when there are extraordinary migration circumstances. It'll provide $18 billion in supplemental funding for the Department of Homeland Security and $2.5 billion in assistance for newly arrived refugees. It also includes an adjustment of status for Afghan allies, protection for most documented dreamers, and an additional 250,000 immigrant visas. I want to dig into the asylum just a little bit more because it's basically creating a new system for asylum. So the bill moves most new asylum cases to the Department of Homeland Security. No longer would these cases be heard by immigration judges under the Department of Justice. Instead, the people hearing these cases would be asylum officers with the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, which is an agency of Homeland Security. This rule is both for the initial asylum claims and also for most appeals. The idea here is that it is a much faster review and often without attorneys or a deliberative process. Here's some more about the new standard. At the initial interview, an asylum seeker would establish clear and convincing proof that they have a credible fear of persecution if they stay in their country. The standard would change again, as we, and I said this a little bit earlier, it would change from clear and convincing to significant possibility. The bill's authors believe this change would result in the vast majority of applications being rejected. All right, this is from PBS, just to be clear. Something else that's new in this is there are new detention beds and rules. The number of detention beds goes to 50,000. Right now, there are fewer than 40,000. Here's the other thing. When the encounters go above a certain amount, so when they go above like 5,000 per day, Homeland Security must launch their authority to kind of basically shut down the border. So even asylum seekers, once you get to 5,000 per day, would not be able to get in generally. One of those exceptions is unaccompanied minors would be admitted, and people who are in danger of torture and can show that would be permitted. Lastly, I'll just say it allows for more legal immigration. There'll be 50,000 new visas a year for 5 years. And so that's something to consider as well. Chris, as we look at this legislation, tell me general how you feel about it, but also what you think about its prospects.
Yeah, so I'll start with the prospects. I think that it's pretty clear that the bill is kind of dead. It doesn't have support from enough Republicans in the Senate or the House to make it into law. So I don't think it has very good chances at all of passing. While I don't fashion myself like an immigration policy expert, I do know that this is one of the big issues of our time. And it seems like from what you just read and my reading of material, I did not read the actual legislation, but I did read some reviews and some commentary. It does seem like it is, if you are in one of two camps, either like a super pro-restrictionist camp, right? So your view is like, we really need to tamp down on immigration, period. This legislation seems to go further in that direction than anything that I've seen in a long time. Also, if you are more generally interested in tamping down on the chaos at the border, this policy seems to go further in that direction than anything that I've seen in a long time. And so I flip back to the politics of it. I think that it's an opportunity to do something that we haven't done, I mean, since like the early 90s. Right? I mean, this is a long time where, and a lot of the chaos is because we haven't updated our asylum system. We haven't updated a lot of stuff at the border in a very, 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 very long time. And the world has changed and the policies have not. And so this is a good opportunity to do something. It doesn't look like it's going to happen. It seems like Democrats are content to sort of flip this on Republicans. At least they feel like that's what they're doing, is flipping this on Republicans, and with the Republicans reject it, then they'll be able to use that on the campaign trail. I'm not sure that that works, but it also seems like Republicans are content to withhold a win from Biden. You don't want to let him sign a big piece of legislation like this that looks like a victory, and so we'll hold on to this for the election cycle. Maybe they might be correct on that for this election cycle, but I think you should remind yourself, if you're in that camp, how the current group that has power within the Republican caucus got that power. It was challenging an establishment that for a very long time talked one sort of way, but never produced the outcomes that they talked about in real legislation. And so maybe it works for Republicans in this cycle, but I think on the long term, the reason people send you to Congress is to make legislation and solve problems. So none of that looks like it's about to happen right now, though.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of my main frustrations. You guys will probably see in a publication soon, Christianity Today, I'm writing about this issue. So hopefully that'll come out probably around the same time this podcast comes out. It's just the frustration for me is just the bad. I think in general, from Trump to a lot of other congressional Republicans, just been working in bad faith, saying, look, many of them have said in so many words, this is our best election issue. This is the thing that our people are most concerned about. Why would we hand that over and create a deal and help Biden out? Well, because people are suffering and that's your job. And I think it is civic malpractice to not get something done when you have the opportunity, especially on an issue that's this big. But of course, all we think about is the next election cycle. Do I think that Democrats have been perfect on this? Not at all. I think there's been some irresponsible things said about the border, and that a lot of people don't take border security seriously enough on that side. We need to have that conversation, but everybody needs to sit down and do the hard work of democracy and try to get this stuff done. And it's not going to happen. I mean, this is the chance of this getting through are very slim. Many Republicans have basically said it's dead on arrival. Don't think you have the 60 votes in the Senate to get through cloture and all that stuff. We've talked about that. You can go back and listen to what that means, but it just doesn't look like it's going anywhere. And I don't know how many more shots they'll be able to take at this in the near future. So to me, that is disappointing. I'll be honest with you, though. I'm not going to say there's not reasons to push back on some of this stuff. I'm not, I think there are some good reasons to question the money going to Ukraine and so on. You know, this is, what people are saying looks like at best a stalemate. And that's a lot more money to be pushing that way when we say we don't have money to do a lot of other things. So I think that's if somebody pushes back in that regard, that's valid. I don't think anybody has to just say we got to accept this particular policy because it's on the table right now. There's room to push back, but you got to enter the conversation in good faith. And I just don't see that happening. Anything else, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I think you say it. The goal has to be get something done. You get in the room, you negotiate, you get to the best deal that you can. But if you can do significant things for people and for the country, that is what the Congress is there for. And it would be such a breath of fresh air to see something get done. But I'm not holding my breath.
Yep. Well, thank you for that, Chris. As always, a pleasure to be with you. I'm so glad you didn't get fired, man. We'll get to the bottom of where that rumor came from soon, I promise you. All right, folks. Well, thanks for joining us. You know what it is, Ann Camp. There's a cross that neither political conservatism nor progressivism is fit to bear. There's a civic hearing in need of faithful witnesses who love social justice and won't surrender the truth to be loved by the world. Politic with the boldness and compassion of Jesus Christ. Until next time, Ann Camp. Holla at you.
This episode is brought to you in part by the Beyond Ordinary Women Ministries podcast. Do you want to grow in your influence? Bao's episodes feature tips for leaders of any kind, from mentoring one woman to leading a ministry. Browse Bao's podcast at beyondordinarywomen.org.